Basketball Insider.
Some news and notes from around the world of college basketball.
In-studio correspondent for WFAN and CBS Sports Radio.
Attention, please, to John Rothstein. Please report to St. Joe's.
The Insider's Insider.
Joining us now with his thoughts and to break it down, John Rothstein.
It's College Hoops Today with John Rothstein.
Let's put the women and children to bed and go looking for dinner. John Rothstein here on the College Hoops Today podcast, coming to you 52 weeks out of the calendar year. This is our official Atlantic 10 breakdown show. We will cover the conference from soup to nuts. Later in the show, we'll be joined by Dayton head coach Archie Miller, and then even after that, we will go into the nuances of the Atlantic 10 one by one. Want you to check us out on iTunes and subscribe to the College Hoops Today podcast, and also leave us a review. Let us know what you think of the product we're bringing to you 52 weeks out of the calendar year, and also check out the College Hoops Today fan page on Facebook and give us a like. I want to let you know that we are brought to you by Harry's. Stop compromising on your shave and get started with Harry's today. For far too long, you've either paid too much for a comfortable shave or you've settled for a low price but low quality razor. Harry's offers something you've never had before, a great shave at a fair price. Good shave, good price. It's simple. Get the best of both with Harry's. As you've heard me talk about on the podcast before, I enjoy a great shave with Harry's every morning. The blades are super sharp and provide a close, comfortable shave, plus their moisturizing shaving cream is great. Harry's starter set is a great option. For just $15, you get a razor handle, moisturizing shave cream, and three of Harry's five-blade German-engineered razors. Plus, there's a special offer for fans of the show. Harry's will give you $5 off your first purchase with promo code HOOPS. Go to harrys.com right now and look for the Truman set. That's HARRYS.com. Enter code HOOPS at checkout to get $5 off and help support the show. Stop compromising. Give Harry's a try today. And now that we've got you all set up for your shave, we are going to begin our off-season breakdown of the Atlantic 10. And my question is this: when you look at leagues that are outside the quote-unquote Power 5, how good is this league compared to other leagues? And I think we have to look at the Atlantic 10 right now as what it was first, because in 2013 and 2014, the Atlantic 10 broke through in some ways on the national stage. The Atlantic 10 in those 2 years, 2013 and 2014, had a combined 11 bids in the NCAA tournament. Now, something happened after the 2014 season that I was against. I know a lot of the coaches in the league were against it as well. And the Atlantic 10 then switched from 16 league games to 18 league games. And what happened then was, because two more games were added to the schedule for teams in the Atlantic 10, teams could not schedule two additional games in the non-conference portion of the schedule that they could then eventually win and boost their win total. And since that happened in 2015 and 2016, we have seen only a combined six teams from the Atlantic 10 reach the NCAA tournament. In my opinion, it should have been seven, because St. Bonaventure should have made the field of 68 last March. So the question is, how does the national perception of the Atlantic 10 change? Well, it changes when you have really good teams that are going to be factors outside the Power 5 and the Big East. And we have to include the Big East in that conversation with the Power 5, because the Big East just produced a national champion in Villanova. Right now, you look at the Atlantic 10, Dayton and Rhode Island both look like top 25 teams, and VCU is a top 35 team in its second season under Will Wade. So you're going to have three teams right now that are going to have a situation where they're going to come into the year with high-level expectations. Who's next in that league? Davidson is a team that has the best player in the conference in Jack Gibbs, averaged just under 24 points a game last season. I think the situation at LaSalle is as fascinating a situation as we have in terms of off-the-radar teams nationally, because in 2013, John Giannini built a team in North Philadelphia that was predicated on high major transfers, Tyrone Garland from Virginia Tech and Ramon Galloway from South Carolina. And that LaSalle team wound up catching lightning in a bottle and won a game in the first four against Boise State, and then beat Kansas State and Ole Miss back-to-back to advance to the Sweet 16, where it ultimately lost to Wichita State. Now, I don't know if something similar can happen. But here's what I do know. The talent in North Philadelphia right now is as good, in my opinion, as any team in the Atlantic 10. Jordan Price and Cleon Roberts are two double-figure scorers that return, and LaSalle adds three high-major transfers, Pookie Powell from Memphis, B.J. Johnson from Syracuse, and Demetrius Henry from South Carolina, that will probably be in the starting lineup or one of the first two people off the bench. And then there's the wild card of Savon Goodman from Arizona State, who committed to LaSalle, left school. There's still no official word out of North Philadelphia as to whether or not he will return. But if Savon Goodman does return to LaSalle, then all of a sudden you have somebody who is an all-conference player as an undersized five. To me right now, I think you're going into this season with five teams, the top three I talked about, Dayton, Rhode Island, VCU, and then Davidson, LaSalle, lacing them up every time they step on the floor for practice, thinking that they have a chance to play in the NCAA tournament. But the hard thing for the Atlantic 10 is getting games against quality competition that moves the needle, because you're not going to see quality teams from Power 5 leagues or from the Big East want to get into a home-and-home situation with a team from the Atlantic 10 because they have nothing to gain and they have everything to lose. So that affects the Atlantic 10, because if you don't have as many opportunities to get quality wins that move the needle nationally, all of a sudden, your RPI, your strength of schedule, your standing isn't going to carry as much weight when teams in your conference play you. Now, for a while, when Shaka Smart was at VCU, VCU was the anchor program in the Atlantic 10. But that has shifted somewhat to Dayton and Archie Miller. The Flyers have been in three straight NCAA tournaments, and their head coach, the aforementioned Archie Miller, joins us next. This is the College Hoops Today podcast with John Rothstein. This is our Atlantic 10 offseason breakdown. We will continue now our Atlantic 10 offseason breakdown with the head coach of a team that's been to three straight NCAA tournaments. Dayton finished 25-8 last year, and their head coach is Archie Miller. He's on the line right now. And Arch, you are about to begin your sixth season as the head coach of Dayton. Is that a little hard to believe?
Yeah, it really is hard to believe. It's hard to believe it's went this quick, and it's also, you know, sort of hard to believe that some of these guys that you recruited and you're around every day are, you know, going into their seniors and junior years. You know, you meet them in their junior year in high school in many ways. So, you know, definitely feel like we're getting old.
How has the Atlantic 10 changed since you became the head coach at Dayton?
Well, it's changed a lot just in terms of the flux of teams in and out. I also think Bernadette McGlade, our commissioner, her staff and her vision has been incredible. We haven't taken a step back, you know, with all the transition of you know, league alignments and affiliations. I think that's been the one really, really unique thing, is to watch us continue to sort of thrive and getting at large bids to the tournament regardless of who's coming in and out. And I think the one thing that's been really unique in my time here is how underrated the coaching is. And you got guys that have been doing it a long, long time, like Phil Martelli and Bob McKellop. And you have guys that have, you know, sort of been there and done that, and Chris Mooney and some of the other guys in our league. It's just a great league of coaches, John G. Nini all the way down. And it's also, there's a camaraderie, you know, I think within this league. We understand how important we are to one another. So I think that's been good.
You mentioned the term at-large bids, and that's obviously something that's always going to be at the focus of teams that aren't playing in a primary football league. In 2013 and 2014, the Atlantic 10 combined for 11 bids to the NCAA tournament. The past 2 years, it has only come up with six. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, I think the big thing is our league at that stages in 13 and 14 was older. You know, we had a lot of older players at that time. When you looked at, you know, the year we got six teams in the league, it was a very veteran-oriented, senior-oriented teams. And due to graduation, we're one of those leagues that doesn't get the one-and-dones and doesn't reload real fast. You know, we load with classes upon classes, and then we develop them. And in many cases, you know, I think as the league has went to maybe three teams the last couple years, there's a chance here this year and the next year after that. I really think on paper, as you look at some of the rosters, they're getting older again. And I think we'll challenge again for more than three and four, and in many cases maybe even five bids. And you can make the case this year we should have four with St. Bonaventure.
You know, one of the things that obviously changed in those 2 years was the league went from 16 league games to 18 league games. Is that a blessing or is it a curse?
I think it depends on who you're talking to, John. You know, there's a lot of different philosophies and scheduling in our conference. You know, we're not one of those conferences that television's out there creating a lot of matchups, and in some cases getting home games is damn near impossible, and not just from the top but all the way through. So our league has had to be creative, and as the rest of the conferences has went to 18, our league has decided to go to 18. I think we've had two amazing races in our conference through the 18-game conference schedule, and I don't think at all that it's hurt us that we went to 18 games in terms of getting bids. We have to continue to do a great job in the non-conference. You know, that's where the Atlantic 10 is going to make its money, is the non-conference scheduling, and teams doing a great job for who they are and putting themselves in positions to come into conference play, you know, with the winning percentages and marquee wins that as we compete with one another, it doesn't matter. And I think as our league will get more creative over the next couple of years as it continues to evolve and, you know, continue to put matchups that, you know, put teams that maybe need to play each other twice rather than once, you know, down the line is something that maybe to tweak some things we'll look at in the future that will help us even more.
Dayton's Archie Miller here on the College Hoops Today podcast with John Rothstein. You said something interesting there. You said it's damn near impossible to get certain teams to play you in a series. How frustrating is that, especially when you have a program the caliber of Dayton?
Well, it's frustrating. I think scheduling in general is frustrating. It's probably the second hardest thing to do as a college coach other than recruit is schedule, you know, properly and schedule the right games. But it is frustrating. And, you know, I think, you know, right now if you take a look at our profile over the last 3 years or whatever, you know, we played a top 10 non-conference schedule last year, and we're trying to do the same this year. And, you know, really in many people's eyes, the NCAA tournament right now is about, you know, non-conference scheduling and top 100 games and top 50 games and as many as you can get on your schedules to be hopeful. So I would think that a lot of teams in our league, from a numbers perspective, look attractive and you don't look at it as, hey, I don't want to go to St. Bonaventure, hey, you shouldn't be going to Dayton, that's a bad game. To me, at the end of the day, if you're smart in this day and age with the tournament, you need as many good number games as anything, regardless of the matchup. So, but I think that'll always be the case. You know, there's 340-plus coaches out there, and they're all trying to win as many games, and they got to do what's best for them. So they're not going to go out there and try to lose games, to say the least.
You've averaged 26 wins a year the last three seasons, but you went through, you know, a tough time your first 2 years at Dayton. How much did you learn from those first 2 years at Dayton that you didn't make the NCAA tournament versus the past three in which you did?
Well, you know, John, I'm a first-time head coach when I got the job here, and you know, we inherited a solid group of guys. And looking back on it, if I could do it all over again that first year, what I know now, that team could have probably made the NCAA tournament if we would have done a couple things a little bit better.
What would you have done differently?
Well, I think, you know, just the length of practices, you know, the road travel, understanding how your guys' bodies feel, how their minds are in January and February, and you know, we were probably maybe a home loss against a Rhode Island team and Duquesne team that year. Looking back on it from being a tournament team or being right there, we had a good group. But we graduated and we knew what was going to happen was a massive overhaul of recruiting and recruiting classes, you know, that, you know, hopefully would be your backbone as the future, you know, unfolded. And we played a lot of freshmen. You know, we started and played three freshmen in every game my second year, and we just weren't good enough at our system at that time, you know, to realize that getting young and teaching is going to be part of the grind, that that second year we just weren't solid enough. But I felt like going into our third year we had enough pieces. We had worked very hard, and you know, we went through one tough stretch, 1 month where we didn't play real well, but at the end of the day that team got to the tournament in our third year, made a great run. But in your third year at the program, to be able to get to the tournament was a big step for us. And then, you know, coming back off of those years, the culture of getting there and winning games in the tournament has carried us through, you know, in a big game mentality, I feel.
Well, you didn't just make the tournament in your third year. You went to the Elite Eight. How did that alter and really raise the expectations for a fan base that was already rabid to begin with?
Well, they're rabid now. I mean, this place is... You know, this fan base here has been unbelievably supportive from day one. They live and die with our players, but at the same time, they're a very positive fan base. It's a fan base that encourages. They want you to see you do well. And I think that run that we went on in the Elite Eight gave them a moment to really, you know, cherish again. And I think the excitement level hasn't really gone down. Our home crowds are incredible. When we travel to exempt events, we mesmerize the events people in the television because, you know, we're putting triple the amount of people in an exempt event game compared to the other teams that are traveling. And then when we go into postseason play, you know, the NCAA tournament games that we've been a part of, our fans have been spectacular. So I think it's one of the diamonds in the rough out there that most people probably can't appreciate until you're really deeply involved with them is how supportive, how passionate this fan base is, and what we mean to them and what they mean to us. It's an unbelievable relationship.
Well, Dayton has become the flagship program now in the Atlantic, and you've kind of become the face of the league since really Shaka Smart went to Texas. What's that been like for you? Because you're an unassuming guy. I'm curious, what's it been like for you now to kind of step into that chair, and you're still a young head coach?
Well, I'll be honest with you, I don't get caught up in very many things about me or myself, but I'm very proud of where our program is. We aspire to be, you know, in the upper echelon and competing for championships in the Atlantic 10 Conference. That's what we aspire to do. That's what we've been aspiring to do since we got here. And, you know, really realistically, we've been able to get to about our fourth year where we're ready to compete for a league title, you know, not being able to get it done at the end of the regular season 2 years ago at LaSalle, and then not winning the conference tournament championship game against VCU was 0-2. But we came back in year five and were able to break through and win the regular season with a share, and that's huge. And I think just now sustaining it and being there and continuing to develop what we have done and keep building upon it is the biggest thing. And we really respect the league. I really respect the coaches in this league, and to be, you know, considered amongst the top by them is very humbling. But for me, I want our program to be represented the right way, do things the right way, and, you know, the rest will sort of take care of itself.
Did you think you'd be at Dayton this long, considering the success you've had?
I was just hoping they'd keep me a couple years. You know, I think that's the one thing that you get a real, real sense when that press conference is over and you walk in that office for the first time, you say to yourself, all right, here we go. You're being judged on today, and nothing that you've ever done matters anymore. It's about the results, and I think it's a very stressful business. I think there's a lot of pressure on college coaches right now, and to be at a place like this who has supported me through it has been amazing. And, you know, being here as long as I have, I've loved it. I love every minute moving forward. I think what we've done is put ourselves in a position to be one of those programs that can stand alone regardless of league or conference or this and that by our, you know, productivity and our results. And, you know, if you can get these type of results, then you're at a place that, quite frankly, you don't need to, you know, look to stray very far away from.
But let's face it, I mean, college basketball has changed in a lot of ways. Like staying at a place like Dayton, staying at a place like Wichita State has become somewhat fashionable, considering what you might be debating on another side. What do you think's changed in the last 5 years?
Well, I think it's very, very, I think it's a very, very cutthroat business. I think that when you're at a place that you have great support, you have an administration and a community feel on campus that works for you. You're getting players that you enjoy to sell for the right reasons. They're coming for the reasons that you believe in. You know, that type of culture, that type of winning, that type of relationship, it doesn't come every day. And when you find it, you know, you need to really, really hold on to those things as much as you can. I just feel like in 2016, you know, it doesn't matter who you are. The NCAA tournament, really, to be quite frank, in a two-year period of time could end your tenure at a job if you don't make it in certain places. And I think, you know, you want to coach the game, you want to do things the way you want to do it. If you're at a place that allows you to be you, that allows you to, you know, operate the way you want to operate and do things, you know, and reflect the university's image in the right way, and I think that's a place that you need to be. But always looking at the grass is always greener on the other side. Many ways that's not really the case because, you know, I've been in a lot of big places, and you know, things can change very quickly at a place with a fan base or recruiting classes or transfers these days. It's just, you know, it's high risk, and I think, you know, when you have something going good, you need to really hold on to that thing.
Dayton's Archie Miller here on the College Hoops Today podcast with John Rothstein. Your relationship with your brother Sean, who's the head coach of Arizona, how does it differ in season to out of season?
I don't think it differs very much. We communicate regularly, not just about our programs or college basketball. We communicate regularly just in general. And my 2 years with him were two of the most beneficial years of my life in terms of professional aspirations on what you want to do. He's a great teacher, great developer of talent, not only players but his staff. And you know, we talk regularly. We do things in a similar way, you know. And I feel like you know, I'm lucky to have him as a part of it. But we speak regularly in season. We talk about our teams a lot, the schedule, the travel, what's going on in the world. And then in the off season, you know, we get a chance to catch up a little bit, especially on the road and recruiting or whatnot.
Were you surprised that he made the lifestyle change and had this massive weight loss at the start of last season?
No. I think that it was good for him, you know, in many ways. You know, you'd waited for him to sort of, you know, kind of get himself going in another direction. But he's so singularly focused daily by the grind of Arizona and what he needs to do to be a champion there. And in many ways, during the season, he's so consumed with the practices and improving that he's tunnel vision, and he sort of loses the outside world. And coming off of our trip to Greece, I didn't even recognize him a few times on television as the season continued to progress. But I think he's really happy with himself right now. I think he feels really good, and I think that it's probably good for him just due to the stress that he's under and the way that he approaches things as a coach.
What types of things does he tell you that he has to deal with at Arizona that maybe he didn't have to deal with when he was at Xavier, which is obviously comparable to where you're coaching now?
Well, the recruiting is just a different animal, you know, at Arizona. You're dealing with the best of the best, and in many aspirations, those guys don't want to be there very long. And I just think the turnover rate at a place like Arizona, when you have it rolling, is so hard to maintain, and the uptake is, you know, 365 days a year of recruiting. You know, at Xavier or at Dayton, yes, recruiting is the lifeblood, but at the end of the day, what you're hoping to accomplish at Dayton is the culture of development, the culture of classes getting older, you know, the turnover of, you know, seniors graduating, handing the torch down. And I think they have that at Arizona, but I think you also have those diamonds out there that stand out, that leave after a year or two, that you have to replace. And that's not always easy. But I think there's a demand of that job. You know, I think he's probably as good as it's going to get when it comes to trying to, you know, run a program the way he does it, and then also have a chance to win it all every year.
Well, he's got a manual for a lot of different situations in college basketball, but you were forced to deal with something that no coach should have to deal with last month when Steve McElvain passed away tragically. How do you cope with it, Arch, just day to day? How do you deal with your players? What has it been like since the tragedy occurred?
It's been hard. You know, I think the hardest thing is you as a person, you know, have got to find a way to deal with it yourself first. You know, in many ways, when you deal with these players 20 hours a day and their families on the way in and out, you always ask yourself, did I do enough if something doesn't go right with one of them? And this one's one of those ones that really stands out that says, man, I just wish I could talk to him one more time, or I wish I could have just, you know, one more opportunity to kind of help him and do this way. Or, because Steve was really going to be set up for a bright future. I don't think you can ask any coach that played against us or watched us the extreme importance that he started to, you know, about our future, how dominating I felt that he could start to get as he got a year under his belt, and that'll be a big change. But at the end of the day, I look at my staff, I see how they're impacted, I see how the coaches are hurting, I look at our players, I see how they're hurting, and, you know, every day is a different challenge. You know, I think the one thing is to not take for granted at this point in time is, you know, just a 10-minute conversation with a guy and ask him how he's feeling, you know, how are you doing, whatever, can mean the world of difference, you know, for them. And we're going to do that together. Today is actually our first day together since the funeral as a full team. You know, our summer school sessions have been in, you know, in two terms. And our second term, we have everybody here in place. So at around 4:30 will be the first time I've actually seen everybody together for the first time since the funeral. And you got to take a deep breath and know what you say probably at the end of the day is never going to be perfect, but we've got to get ourselves back up off the ground together. We got to give ourselves a chance to have a great six-week prep time here in our second summer session to plan for our season. We have a Spain trip on August 5th that we're all looking forward to that, you know, quite frankly, is going to put us together a lot. And my hope is that our togetherness is unmatched and that they'll appreciate this grind and being together more so than ever, because we've realized in a very quick way how things can change and never be the same. And I think, you know, whether it be tomorrow or 10 years or 15 years, you know, that day will always be impactful to everyone that was in this program. And, you know, it's tough to deal with. It's very, very hard to deal with. But at the same time, you know, you have to find a way to do things together, and hopefully we'll help each other.
What did you say to your players individually or together when you talked to them after Steve passed away? What was the dialogue?
You know, the unfortunate thing was, John, we had just finished our spring semester, and guys were all off campus starting that Friday. Steve included left Friday after his last class, and some guys had about 7 days before our next summer session started, and some guys were going home for about 4 or 5 weeks until this second summer. So we were sort of in that break mode, that deep breath of like, wow, got a chance to take a deep breath before we come back. And I'll never forget it, leaving the Atlantic 10 coaches meeting on a Wednesday in the security line. I got a call from Alan Griffin, and I knew something right away wasn't right. And it was a very difficult trip home from Florida. And then once we got there, we got to Fort Wayne first to see the family. And then we had our chances individually to speak to our players. And then as they got back as a group for the very first time going to Steve's service, you know, it was difficult. But I will tell you this. I got some good advice for some people. College basketball world reached out amazingly. The Atlantic 10 is outstanding. Their administrators, the league officials, coaches, I can't tell you how many people I talked to that reached out from support. But I will say this. I've never been in a room on more occasions that I didn't know what to say or how to say it. And I think that what I've realized is, and what I've learned is, it's okay not to know what to do. You're not supposed to know what to do. You're not supposed to know how to fix this. So take it day by day, and as time moves on, you'll learn a little bit more about your group and how to manage them and how to deal with it. But it was very, very unorthodox for me. Usually when you stand in front of your team, you got to show that face that everybody wants to see, and you tell them something they need to hear. And in many ways, I don't think anybody really knew what to take back, and it still feels funny now. You know, it really does. It still feels awkward right now. We'll have unofficial visit after unofficial visit, John, and you watch film and you show kids their opportunity here and you show how we develop them and your style of play, and it's all fun. But on every single one of those films, Big Steve's running around in the game, and you can't help but to look around the room and see the coaches on our staff sort of just watching the film saying, I see Steve out there. And so there's always going to be those images that kind of trigger you back to him. The good thing about Big Steve was there wasn't a bigger character that I've ever come across. So most of the time when you think back to him, you'll start laughing.
Dayton's Archie Miller here on the College Hoops Today podcast with John Rothstein. Well, the only choice you have in life or in basketball is to move forward, so you move forward. How does your team look now next season without that big piece in the middle that was expected to play a prominent role?
Well, obviously, Steve's a game changer defensively, and from an offensive standpoint, you know, his size and length were something that was a curveball for us. But we're very comfortable playing skilled, we're very comfortable playing fast, and we're very comfortable dealing with forwards and undersized guys, and that's what we'll be about this year. We're going to be hard to guard. I think our freshman class going into their sophomore year, if they make a big jump, really, really going to improve. I don't necessarily feel like there's a team out there that has three or four guys that have played more minutes or a bigger role together as a starting group than Scoochie Smith, Kyle, Kendall Pollard, and then adding in Charles. Josh Cunningham's transfer year sat out, did a great job getting himself ready to go. I think he's a guy that has a chance to impact our league a lot like some of the other transfers that we've had. But the quest for us will be, how do all these pieces fit together? From a style perspective, how are we going to have to win games playing a little bit undersized? But I think in the end of the day, the overall depth of our team is going to be so much better 1 through 5 coming off the bench, because they got some run last year as freshmen and they're having a great off season. And once you get to that sophomore year, that's the big jump. So you hope that some of these guys who played minimal roles now, as they get their chance, you know, can really add to the piece rather than be there. Yes, Steve is a big part of what we're doing, but I feel like we had a chance, regardless of Steve's on the court or off, to be successful.
Has it been harder to break through and make the NCAA tournament after the first 2 years you had at Dayton, or has it been harder to sustain the level, the high level, which you've put in place?
I think the high level of sustaining is the thing that is the driving force here. I think sustaining it is a lot harder than getting there. I think getting there is like constant motivation of recruiting and building and depth, and you're on that mission to get there. And once you crack it, it's like, great. But we don't want to be the program that makes it, and then, hey, a couple years later, that you forget about them. We've been able to stay on the forefront of college basketball in many ways because of some of the runs that we've had. And I think staying here as we graduate a couple guys that have been a part of those big, big wins and some of these good seasons, you know, we're at a pivotal time where the next couple recruiting classes are really going to carry us over the next three, four, five seasons. So sustaining it is definitely harder than getting there.
Arch, appreciate your time. Look forward to seeing you on the road in July. Thank you.
Okay, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's Dayton's Archie Miller. We will break down the rest of the Atlantic 10 from soup to nuts when we return here on the College Hoops Today podcast. We'd like to thank Dayton head coach Archie Miller for joining us here on the College Hoops Today podcast with John Rothstein. We are in the middle right now of our Atlantic 10 offseason breakdown. Please check us out on iTunes, subscribe to the College Hoops Today podcast, and give us a like, give us a review, tell us what you think of the product we're bringing to you every single week of the calendar year. And also, check out the College Hoops Today fan page on Facebook. Give us a like and tell us what you think of what we're bringing to you in terms of insight and perspective each and every week. Our focus this week is on the Atlantic 10. So now let's find out, heading into the 16-17 season, who is ranked where.
John's Atlantic 10 Power Rankings.
Dayton is clearly number one for me in the Atlantic 10. Rhode Island right behind them at number two. EC Matthews returns for the Rams. Also, Indiana transfer Stan Robinson will become eligible for Danny Hurley's crew. To me, that's a top 20 team in America. Number three is VCU. Number four is Davidson with the 1-2 punch of Jack Gibbs and Peyton Aldridge. Five is LaSalle. GW is at six. Love the potential 1-2 punch of Jaren Cena and Tyler Cavanaugh for Mike Lonergan's club. Also have a key returning starter back in Yuta Watanabe. St. Bonaventure and Jalen Adams are seven. Richmond is eight. UMass is at number nine. This to me is the mystery team in the Atlantic 10, a great recruiting class, and also a redshirt freshman in Lawani Pipkins, who could be the future of the program at point guard. There's been a lot of buzz out of Amherst about Lawani Pipkins, and that buzz is palpable. St. Joe's 10, Duquesne 11, George Mason 12, Fordham is 13, and St. Louis is 14. But right now, who is the best player in the Atlantic 10?
John's Atlantic 10 Preseason Player of the Year.
It's Jack Gibbs from Davidson. Last year, his numbers, 23.5 points, 4.9 assists, and 4.1 rebounds. Jack Gibbs is not Stephen Curry, but he's still one of the better players in college basketball. Bob McKillop has done a really good job adding to his supporting cast this year. Jack Gibbs makes Davidson a contender for the NCAA tournament. Jack Gibbs is one of, obviously, the best players in the country, but who are the other top players in the Atlantic 10?
John's Atlantic 10 Preseason First Team.
I mentioned Jack Gibbs from Davidson. Jalen Adams from the Bonnies is also on that team. EC Matthews only played 10 minutes last season for Rhode Island before suffering a torn ACL, but there's a good chance he would have been drafted in last week's NBA draft had he been healthy. Was terrific in the Adidas Nations in the summer of 2015. Charles Cook from Dayton, again, another Player of the Year candidate, averaged in double figures last year, was terrific after transferring from James Madison. And then Tyler Cavanaugh from GW rounds out the first team for the Atlantic 10. Gibbs, Adams, Matthews, Cook, and Cavanaugh. Tyler Cavanaugh was a part of a GW team that won 28 games in the postseason NIT at Madison Square Garden. And that brings us to our Atlantic 10 sleeper for next year. Who is it?
John's Atlantic 10 sleeper.
I'm going to go with GW as my Atlantic 10 sleeper for next season. The Colonials have been very consistent under Mike Lonergan once he was able to get the roster into a decent position. I don't think this is Mike Lonergan's most talented team that he's had at GW, but you've got an all-conference player in Cavanaugh. You've got a dynamite Atlantic 10 level point guard in Jaren Cena. I mentioned Yuta Watanabe, and also I like the role players that this program has added. We've got a situation where you have Kevin Marfo at power forward. GW beat out several Big East teams in recruiting for his services. And then an underrated pickup for GW in the spring recruiting period was Patrick Steves, an immediately eligible graduate transfer from Harvard. He averaged over 9 points a game last year for the Crimson. GW is the sleeper team next year in the Atlantic 10. But who are some fresh faces to keep an eye on next year in the conference?
John's freshman to watch in the Atlantic 10.
Here's five freshmen to watch next year. I already mentioned Kevin Marfo and Lawani Pipkins from UMass. Those are two to put on your list. The next name is somebody that I think VCU fans are really going to have an enjoyment of watching the next couple of years, and that's Deriante Jenkins from Hargrave Military Academy. The small forward is versatile. He probably wouldn't have been recruited by Kentucky or Duke, but any other program in the country would have taken Deriante Jenkins. He could have played at Georgetown. He could played at Florida. He could have played at Texas. He could have played at Utah. He is that good. He has a chance to start as a freshman for VCU. Another UMass kid on this list, DeJean Giroux, a top 65 player nationally, and also one from Rhode Island, Cyril Langevin, who played at the Patrick School in New Jersey. He will be called upon for Danny Hurley's team to bring some key minutes off the bench, backing up both Hassan Martin and Karan Iverson. We've talked a lot about some key freshmen. What about some key transfers in the A-10 for next season?
Sean's transfers to watch in the Atlantic 10.
We start right now with Dayton's Josh Cunningham. Josh Cunningham averaged about 8 points and 8 rebounds a game 2 years ago at Bradley. I think he's got a chance to start up front for the Flyers next year, next to Kendall Pollard. Going to go to Will McGarity and Davidson next. Will McGarity was somebody who was recruited by Steve Donahue to play at Boston College. 6'11", great size. Really good feel for the game. I think he is a potential starter for Davidson. Could be their starting big man up front next to Peyton Aldridge. Mentioned Jaron Cena from GW earlier in the podcast, the transfer from Seton Hall. He'll get the keys to the car for Mike Lonergan and Foggy Bottom. And then two others to keep an eye on in terms of impact A-10 transfers, B.J. Johnson from Syracuse, Pookie Powell from Memphis. These two players, again, one was given a scholarship from Memphis at a high school. One was given a scholarship from Jim Boeheim at a high school. They are now on the front lines for LaSalle. A LaSalle team is one of the most intriguing ones in college basketball. We've talked about freshmen. We've talked about transfers to keep an eye on the A-10. How about breakout guys?
John's Atlantic 10 breakout players for next season.
I'm going to go with somebody who I thought was key to VCU last year in terms of making sure that their engine never was able to be turned off, and that's Johnny Williams, the point guard. I thought Will Wade's team got to a different level when he decided to implement the two-point guard attack with Johnny Williams and Jaquan Lewis in the backcourt together. And look, I've been covering VCU for a long time right now. Some of the same attributes that I saw in Darius Theus, who was a very good point guard under Shaka Smart, I'm starting to see in Johnny Williams. Zarius Williams from Dayton is another one on my radar. I also like Lamar Fresh Kimball from St. Joe's. St. Joe's is going to need offense after losing both DeAndre Bembry and Isaiah Miles. Tony Washington from LaSalle has glue guy potential, averaged just under 8 points and 8 rebounds last year for the Explorers. And when you look at LaSalle's roster and you see Jordan Price and you see Johnny Schuler and you see Cleon Roberts and then you add B.J. Johnson and Pookie Powell, you're going to need people that can have a great impact on the game by not demanding shots. To me, that's Tony Washington in a nutshell. And I also think Denzel Gregg will be a breakout guy from St. Bonaventure. The Bonnies lost a key piece up front in Deion Wright. To me, Denzel Gregg is the guy that steps in to that role. We've given you the breakdown that we've wanted to give you on the Atlantic 10. We are going to break down one major conference from now until the beginning of September. Next week, we will take an in-depth look at the American Conference. We'll be back same bat time, same bat channel, as well as the College Hoops Today podcast with John Rothstein.